And we'll move to the fifth case this morning, United States v. Daniel, case number 132399. Mr. Mohabbat?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Amir Mohabbat. I represent the appellant in this matter, Felix Daniel. This appeal raises two issues. The first one is whether the district court erred when it did not give an instruction to the jury that jurors had to agree on at least one false pretense, representation, promise, or act charged in the indictment.
Did you tender such an instruction?
Not specifically in writing, however, at the jury instruction conference, which I believe was on or about March 13th, this issue was brought up verbally.
It ran back and forth, but there was no tendered instruction that was refused.
That's correct, Your Honor. The second issue on this appeal is whether the district court erred when it denied Mr. Daniels' motion for a judgment of acquittal. As to this first issue, and this may be an issue of first impression in this circuit, we know that a defendant is entitled to the right to have a jury unanimously determine his or her guilt. And if the argument flows forward from there. So if participation in a scheme to defraud is an element of wire and mail fraud, and the scheme is an element, then it flows that the scheme has to be made up of the false pretenses.
That issue has come up in other circuits, has it not?
Three that I know of, the first, the eighth, and the ninth.
Did they rule in favor of your argument, or did they rule the other way?
They seem to have all ruled in favor of the government in those cases, but we respectfully disagree
so
with all those.
I didn't expect you to agree with them all, Professor. If what you're asking us to do is to create a difference between among the circuits.
That's what we would effectively be asking for. However, I think the primary reason those circuits all got it wrong, and the first one was relying on the eighth and the ninth, is because I think they've misapplied the Supreme Court's case, Richardson. Richardson is a case where the defendant was charged pursuant to the continuing criminal enterprise statute. I believe that was a drug case. This case, the Daniel case, according to the evidence and the indictment, had to do with an ongoing alleged violation by Mr. Daniel, continuous. And these are the types of buzzwords that are apparent in the Richardson case. Judge Gostrall in the lower court relied on this case's Gibson decision, 530 F3rd 606. Gibson was about murder for hire. Gibson was about one particular incident, one moment in time. It was not continuing. It was not continuous. That's why it was differentiated from the U.S. Supreme Court's Richardson case. However, initially, I think the district court judge was on the right path. She said, and I turn to page 1000.
She knew the issue was there.
Pardon me?
She knew the issue was there.
I believe so. And
well, I don't doubt that a bit. I mean, the committee, if I recall correctly, anticipated the issue as well and said it's not come up yet.
In the comments of 4.04, yes. And Judge Gostrall had said, Gibson relies on Richardson for the contention that a unanimity instruction must be given. And I think the government persuaded her otherwise at the jury instruction conference. With that being said, you know, we acknowledge the First, the Eighth, and the Ninth Circuits, but those decisions are not binding on this court. However, the U.S. Supreme Court's Richardson decision is. Concerning the second issue, the motion for a judgment of acquittal should have been granted. Unsupported inferences and speculation cannot support a finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The government tried to establish Mr. Daniels' criminal intent by showing that he was a member of RIMTEC and an employee whose job was sales, so that because he promoted the program on the front end, he should be held criminally liable on the back end, even though the evidence at trial showed it was actually somebody else who was making the financial decisions, the managerial operation decisions, and the investment decisions. The government tried to blur the lines between Mr. Daniel, the man, and other employees and the company on the other hand, blur them together, because otherwise a rational juror could not reasonably have found Mr. Daniels to have had criminal intent. And a strong suspicion that someone is involved in an activity is no substitute for proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And then specifically with regard to counts 2, 3, and 4, which were all the mail count offenses, there was a lot of evidence at trial that when Mr. Daniel was responsible for the content of one or more letters, he signed them, or in some other way he ratified they were from him, foreseeably from him, or authorized by him, or otherwise adopted after the fact. That didn't happen concerning the letters dated November 1, 2006 that are brought up in counts 2, 3, and 4 of the indictment. And then with regard to foreseeability, I think the government's definition of foreseeable sounds a lot like more the definition for what is speculation. The district court's opinion, when the motion for a judgment of acquittal was denied, relied on the Pereira decision from the U.S. Supreme Court that's, I think at this point, almost 60 years old. And in Pereira, the defendant received a check in the mail from, I believe, a bank that he had defrauded. That's a whole different fact pattern than what we have going on here. And the government cites to this case's Alexander case. Fact pattern is very different there as well. In Alexander, Mr. Alexander made a false insurance claim. Their insurance company asked a third entity to mail proof of damage to the insurance company, and it was that mailing that was the basis for the conviction. And, you know, maybe that sounds great. However, in this case, the facts are very different. The district court and the government take the position, well, maybe Mr. Daniel could have known that somebody might be mailing something. That's speculation. That's too uncertain. So I think the judgment of acquittal should have been granted, and at a minimum, this matter should be remanded for a new trial with the jury instruction that we seek. I don't believe, Judge Bauer, the issue was waived below or forfeited. We brought it up of record, and my co-counsel said I lodged the objection.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Apparently not. You've reserved the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Fine. Mr. Lee.
May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Lee on behalf of the United States. The district court here correctly instructed the jury that it had found that to convict the defendant of wire and mail fraud, that one of the elements was that the defendant participated in a scheme to defraud, which operated by means of materially false representations, as described in the indictment. Those instructions leave no doubt as to what crimes that the jury convicted the defendant of, especially when it was undisputed that the described representations were indeed false. These particular representations were means by which the scheme operated, not elements of the wire fraud or mail fraud offenses, and the jury was not required to reach unanimity as to the particular means that the defendant used to commit his fraud, especially given the undisputed nature that these representations were in fact false. Moreover, the evidence was sufficient to support the convictions, and the district court correctly denied defendant's Rule 29 motions. There was sufficient evidence to support the conclusion that the defendant did know and have criminal intent in defrauding the homeowners. There were his false statements to the homeowners both before and after they entrusted their homes to him. There were his promises that the homes would be safe even when the company was providing insufficient money to meet its mortgage obligations. There was the defendant's active role in the company, which grew over time, and his continuing lies to the homeowners. Defense counsel also acknowledged in his opening brief that there was sufficient evidence to show that the defendant had sufficient knowledge about the intent to defraud the lenders. He tries to carve that aside, But the fraud on the lenders was a significant part of the fraud scheme. There were two parts, defrauding the homeowners in order to defraud the lenders to get the equity that the defendant acquired from his victims. And finally, there was sufficient evidence to support the findings that the defendant caused the mails to be used, given the homeowner testimony about the receipt of mails, the defendant's active role in the company at that time, and even his discussion with one of the witnesses about one of the mailings that occurred in connection with the mass mailings that were charged. Unless the court has any questions, the government asks that you affirm the conviction.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mohabit, you've got 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think Mr. Lee may have misread or unintentionally in good faith mischaracterized. We're not saying Mr. Daniel knew there was a lender being defrauded. There was a footnote. They made reference to one particular witness who we think has absolutely no credibility, and that a rational juror would not have believed a word she had said. That was the footnote comment we had made there. Concerning, though, the first issue, and Mr. Lee did not discuss the Richardson case in the Supreme Court, we cannot just sweep that under the rug. Richardson is on point. It should be controlling. And I think if the First, Eighth, and Ninth Circuits had put more consideration into that case, they wouldn't have ruled the way they had in the Lyons, the Rice, and the LaPlante cases. Are there any questions?
Apparently not. Thank you, counsel. And our thanks to both counsel. Mr. Mohabit, were you appointed in this case?
I was.
We thank you for your service to your client and to the court.
Thank you.